From the Melanina Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona, this is Keeping Up with Public Health, Pandemic Response. This episode, we speak with Agnes Adakai, Sheila Soto, and Dr. Paloma Beamer. Agnes Adakai is the Director of Health Disparities Outreach and Prevention Education for the Center of Health Equality at the University of Arizona College of Public Health. Sheila Soto works with the Primary Prevention Mobile Health Unit Program, a university initiative that provides preventative health services and screenings to immigrant communities. And Dr. Beamer is an associate professor at the College of Public Health at the University of Arizona, where she holds joint appointments as an associate professor of chemical and environmental engineering and as a research scientist in the Asthma and Airway Disease Research Center. Our conversation focuses on health disparities and the potential lasting impacts the COVID-19 pandemic may leave with Native American communities and Latin American migrant populations. Let's dive in.
Sheila and Agnes, you work directly with the Latino populations and the Native populations, mainly in Arizona. Sheila, would you like to start us off and tell us a little bit about your work?
Yes, of course. I help manage the Primary Prevention Mobile Health Unit here in Tucson. We serve Southern Pinal County, Pima County, Santa Cruz County, and Cochise. And normally, or pre-COVID, we would go out into the community and provide free preventative health screenings in areas that we know that there's health professional shortage areas, maybe lack of transportation, lack of access to health services. And we provided these services, this education, with the means of getting our community members into federally qualified health centers or other community health centers. But with everything happening in March and the closures and stay-at-home orders, we had to switch gears to now calling all of our participants that we've seen them in the last 3 years and asking them how they're doing with everything going on with COVID. And through our calls, like, we've seen that some of our families were let go. And I mean, that really does affect their entire family, because the majority of the people that we see in the mobile health unit, their household entirely. So if there's three adults working, they're reporting to be making less than $3,000 a month. So we can see that even just one person being let go or being cut hours is going to affect them. So before COVID, where we really would focus on getting our community members into federally qualified health centers, now we're really focusing on getting them referred to food banks, diaper banks, or any other type of food distribution, getting them into organizations that are providing free rental assistance or billing assistance. One thing of the mobile unit is that we don't normally, I mean, we never turn anybody away. So that includes our undocumented families. And unfortunately, a lot of the services and policies being put in place are not available for our undocumented families. So they're ineligible for many of the programs that are coming out, which is really hard and frustrating, because there's hardly any other organizations that do provide that support for undocumented families. And that's a hard conversation to have.
Agnes, can you tell us a little bit about your work and the communities you're working with and how they've been impacted?
Thank you. So my name is Agnes Adakai, and I work over at the Center for Rural Health over at the Melanina Zuckerman College of Public Health. And my role is as a Director of Health Disparities Outreach and Prevention Education. So in that role, I assist tribal communities and underserved communities across Arizona with information. So I disseminate a lot of information on events, trainings, grants, resources. I also provide technical assistance. I'm a convener and a liaison to several committees and groups across Arizona. So my particular area of focus is working with Native American communities. I am a Navajo, and I grew up on the Navajo Reservation in a small community called Tisto, which is about 40 miles north of Winslow and about 40 miles south of Second Mesa. So as you've heard in the news, the Navajo Nation has been severely impacted by COVID. And when that happened, our office went into work in helping with the hospitals and clinics across northern Arizona and assisting with a lot of the volunteers up in the area with their mutual aid programs. And also, fortunately, we do have a lot of alumni from our College of Public Health who are currently working as physicians, as epidemiologists, and folks who work in Indian Health Service managing the COVID response. And so we've been sending information back and forth to them. And the Navajo Nation in particular has, as I said, has been really hit hardest. It's about 27,000 square miles across three states. So it's the size of West Virginia. And in that size of West Virginia, the majority of people, there's like 173,000, about 43 live below the poverty line and 42% are unemployed. 30% have no running water. And then one in five have about, there's high prevalence of obesity. There's also underlying conditions such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol. And in terms of the hospital facilities, there are like a dozen, there's about 12 medical facilities that hold just 200 beds. And so when we saw a surge in cases of COVID cases, the Navajo Nation immediately start running out of beds. And so they start flying folks out to Tucson and Phoenix. And when those were at capacity, then they started flying folks to Albuquerque. So in response, the Navajo Nation started a really stringent public health policy of mandatory mask wearing. In the state of Arizona, it wasn't mandatory, but on the Navajo Nation, it was. And they did strict mandatory lockdowns. And so we've had high numbers of cases, but they've been stabilizing so far. And so I think the challenges in the Navajo community are the infrastructure challenges, the lack of access to water. So folks are unable to wash their hands as frequently as the CDC recommends. And of course, in places where there's no electricity, there's challenges with working from home if they're able to, or for students who have were sent home to do homework at home. So that was a challenge too. So the infrastructure really has impacted folks. And so our work is trying to connect people to resources, to people doing the work, to providing information and data and resources to help the communities fight COVID. In particular, in my family, I've had two cousins who had COVID and were flown to Phoenix, and they are doing well now, but they're suffering from the after effects of weakness and possibly long-term health impacts. In addition, as I said, a lot of our folks are unemployed, and the major employment in my family was the casino, the gaming facilities on the Navajo Nation. I had a lot of my cousins and relatives who worked at the casino, which is the Twin Arrows, closest to Winslow and Flagstaff. And they had been paid on paid leave, but now since the casinos have started running out of reserves, they're now laying off people. So a lot of folks who are no longer going to have jobs. And so personally, it's affected my family physically and also economically, but also emotionally too, knowing that you are unable to see folks. I live in Tucson. My family lives up in northern Arizona. It's a 7-hour drive. I am unable to visit with them due to protecting them and myself. And then many times I'm not able to Zoom or connect with them because of lack of cell phone access or video access. So those are the challenges impacting me in the work that I do.
Thank you for sharing that. What are some of the longer-term impacts that you all see as affecting these communities the most?
I guess I could start off saying from my lens as somebody who works in exposure science. So compared to epidemiologists who look at exposures and how that relates to disease, I look at how people get exposed. And when you think about that, it was already an issue for these communities. They already were exposed to much higher levels of contaminants, like Agnes was saying, less access to clean water, like less access to clean air. And many of the occupations also put them at greater risk of exposure, right? So you have people who are more likely to be exposed because they're essential workers, they're on the front lines, they're still picking our food, they're still working in small businesses. Like you said, Agnes, with the casinos, they're interacting with the public on a more regular basis, and they're also more likely to work in healthcare.
and not perhaps as the physicians, but where they're actually working on, you know, with the patients and in face-to-face contact. And this leads to, I think, greater exposures in that community. And then there's a lot of work showing now that there's a big intersection between severity of the disease and your previous exposure to environmental contaminants and contamination in your community. And then there's also the concern of how do we isolate within homes once somebody comes down with coronavirus? How do we prevent everybody else in the household? And it might be more difficult in some of these communities. So I think the long-term effects are going to come from increased exposure, increased prevalence of the disease. And then, as Agnes was saying, the long-term health consequences that we're still just learning. Even in young people, it seems like there's going to be some pretty severe long-term health consequences. They're going to make it harder for people to go back and resume their work. A lot of these jobs are not able to be done remotely. They may not get unemployment for very long. A lot of small businesses are going to be devastated and are still being devastated. And so these are going to impact these communities far more than the communities who already have access to health insurance and have access, the ability to work from home.
So from my perspective, this is Agnes, I think there's the negative long-term aspects, but also possibly sort of the brighter ways of looking at how the pandemic has really opened our eyes to the disparities in what we really need to do to change the environment for the better so that we're prepared the next time, which we know will we know that will eventually come. But I think for Navajo, there's been a lot much talk and discussion regarding ensuring that families have water now. So part of the CARES funding, the $600 million that was provided to the Navajo Nation, our Navajo Nation president has allotted some of the funds to go to developing the infrastructure for piped water into homes, but also looking at ensuring that there is adequate water supplies for those who aren't able to get piped water, you know, hopefully working with some of the nonprofit organizations and advocates out there who are providing water to folks, because a lot of our folks on the Navajo Nation get their water from unregulated well sources. So you get 55-gallon drums and you take it in your car and in your truck and you fill it up at the wells and then you bring it back home. And so depending on how much you use, you can go through a lot, a 55-gallon drum, you know, you can go through a lot of water. So Navajo Nation is looking at piped water for a lot of communities. And then looking at how education is provided, you know, I have a daughter who currently is looking at remotely going to school using the internet. And now Navajo Nation is looking at, you know, broadband. How can we provide Wi-Fi and internet access to our community so they're able to access that schoolwork? Then we're looking at a lot of young people who are looking at public health as a career now. They're now knowing what an epidemiologist does. They are looking at what CHRs are doing. They're looking at other health professions, and they're seeing the value in that. And I'm sure there's going to be more opportunities for folks to encourage our young Native people to go into these health professions. But I think it's provided an opportunity for us to really look at the infrastructure that needs to be provided to our Navajo community to be better prepared. But it also highlighted how our system of kinship in the Navajo systems, where we're kins, we have clans, how our kinship has been reactivated. And so these mutual aid societies have been created from Navajo Hopi COVID response to up in the Shiprock area to local ones, how they've been able to bring food and resources to community members, all volunteer work. So again, looking at the strengths of a community and how they respond to an emergency. So those are the positive aspects of such a response. But again, you know, looking at the negative, we're still looking at those long-term health outcomes of folks. You know, how is that going to impact, you know, people going back to work, going to school? You know, for a community that's already has high rates of diabetes, chronic health, chronic lung conditions and heart disease, and getting COVID, how is that going to impact our people? And how is the large number of deaths of people, especially the elderly, how is that going to impact the ability of Navajo people to transmit the cultural knowledge to future generations? And so that's been a lot of the talk among people and the concerns that people have stated to me, and also on social media and in a lot of our meetings. So there's just a lot of uncertainties out there that, you know, it's going to have a long-term response. And I know with Navajo, when we had the Spanish flu back in 1918, we had about, I think it was about a fourth of our people, about 2,000 or 3,000 die of the Spanish flu. And that changed Navajo society. That changed to where they started observing Navajo traditions and customs again. And the same thing with H1N1, which had there was a lot of people who were impacted by H1N1 back in 2009. And again, really looking at how Navajo society, going back to the cultures and traditions, how does that impact our health and well-being? And so COVID-19 has also brought that out. We're going back to looking, since our kids are home, we're looking at how to transmit that traditional cultural knowledge, the language, the foods, and how we isolate, and how we are, you know, our kins, and how we provide support to others. And so I think there's the negative and the positive responses to the outcomes of COVID.
Thank you. And Sheila, can you tell us a little bit about what farm workers and the Latino community is going through?
So I should have started with that at the beginning as well. I should have said that I myself identify as Latina, Latinx. I am the daughter of immigrants, and I'm also a part of the farm worker community. So I'm very passionate and very protective of the safety and the well-being of this community. And I know here in Arizona, and as well as other states in the U.S., there have been continuous outbreaks of COVID in farm worker communities and places of work. Just this morning, I was in a training with the National Center of Farm Worker Health, and I learned that in agricultural areas with H2A workers, there have been over 3,500 positive cases of COVID reported. And that's through like informal means of them finding out, of like news media getting a hold of the information and sharing it, because otherwise there would be no other way for them to get this information. We can see how that's a problem, because it not only is hurting our families here, but with H2A workers, well, they're going to go back to their home country as well. So we're helping spread to other more vulnerable countries too. And we know that farm worker conditions often do not allow them to practice the 6 feet of distancing, and often their employers do not reinforce the idea of wearing masks. For example, my parents have been, and they continue to be, farm workers, and I know that their employer does not require masks, and they do not provide any masks. And they're working elbow to elbow. So there's literally no way for them to practice what's being suggested by the CDC or by other health entities. And honestly, to me, it comes down to it being the responsibility of the employer. Like, it really should be up to them that they allow farm workers to practice the 6 feet of separations, for them to provide the face mask, for them to provide access to hand sanitizer or hand washing stations. And then also looking at the area of housing or other communal areas where farm workers usually tend to congregate. We know from past experiences that employers tend to pack these housing facilities with more than the max capacity. So in these current circumstances, I do believe that employers should be held responsible if they're not implementing the proper safety precautions needed to reduce the chances of outbreaks. And farm workers, like I mentioned earlier, are one of the least protected employees in the U.S. So the minimum federal wage is at $7.25, and farm workers are not required to get time and a half paid when they do overtime. So that means if somebody becomes ill, it will greatly affect the wages for the household. And even though policies were implemented like the CARES Act, which was to provide support for employees who may directly, either through like a household member or personally, be affected by COVID, often farm workers are an exception to these policies. So anyone having to choose between having to feed their families, keeping a roof over their heads, would be willing to sacrifice their own well-being for their family, which is exactly what we're seeing. And even here in Arizona, I know that we've had death of farm workers. And I feel like it's completely being overlooked. And here in Arizona, you know, because we're so close to the border, we have the transportation that brings farm workers from Mexico into the farms here in Arizona. And these buses and these vans are not practicing the 6 feet of distancing either. Once again, showing how if employers were held responsible, they would be implementing those practices and providing more for more transportation or other safety measures to help prevent the death of farm workers.
Now what's happening in the news is a big salmonella outbreak with onions. And I don't know why I'd never thought of it before, but it's like, yeah, the conversation kind of centers around how it's going to affect the general public when there's an E. coli outbreak and when there's any type of something wrong with our food. But that is rarely extended out to the people who actually farmed the food to begin with, because they were probably exposed higher concentration than everybody else, but we never hear those stories. Paloma, can you comment on that?
I guess I don't have a lot of comments related to those kinds of outbreaks in, in food like that and how it's tracked. But I think you're right with the farm workers, and it brings up a couple other memories, not necessarily related to coronavirus, but to some of my earlier work, you know, with pesticide exposures. I worked with a group that had a cohort in California amongst the farm workers there, and they spent a lot of time just bringing warm water to the field so people could wash their hands, because nobody was washing their hands because there was no water provided to wash your hands. And they found that reduced the level of pesticides in their urine substantially. So those are important issues that would also, and the thing about washing your hands, it also controls for infectious disease. But I'm thinking more along some of the work that I've done with a very large agricultural facility in Sonora, where they're very concerned about outbreak with the food. So the large packing facilities are almost pristine environments where you have to cover yourself and everything to come in. But we started working with this farm because we were working with them on the housing conditions, like Sheila laid out, where our students measured that each farm worker had 8 square feet to themselves in the housing that they're provided. So I don't know if they've changed that in the pandemic. But when you have 8 square feet, that's 4 feet by 2 feet per person. There's no way you're going to get 6 feet at all around anybody in that kind of an environment. And it's that dichotomy that was really, you know, obvious to us, that the grapes were treated with way more care and support than the workers themselves. And Sheila, I want to thank your family for all their work and all the work that you do, because I think that's the thing that we all have to remember, is that the food that we're able to go buy at the store right now and bring home and eat safely in our homes is being picked by people who don't have those same precautions. The meatpacking plants also don't. All these other places that make it so that we can eat our own food. And so, yes, occasionally there might be an outbreak like the salmonella and onions. I hadn't heard of that yet. But that's, like you said, it's small compared to the exposures and the risks they put themselves on the line every day. And I think this pandemic has really just highlighted those disparities more. I like how Agnes, how you added the hopeful parts and the parts that are changing. And Sheila, it doesn't sound like that's being applied to the farm worker community, which is, I think, you know, this could also be a time to highlight some of those disparities and try to change how some of that happens.
Yeah, I think that's the hard part with those of us who are working with farm working communities, that we see these things even more right now, and while at the same time they're trying to help them, trying to make other people aware of it. And I understand also trying to be hopeful, but it's just a little hard right now. And I do think, for example, one of the ways that we try to help here at the College of Public Health is providing the educational materials and outreach in ways that possibly are not typically done. So I know, for example, in Yuma, they have a radio station that's geared towards farm workers, and that's how they're sharing the safety practices. So I think that's one positive thing that I think we are seeing now, is a lot of organizations coming together to provide these resources and services to vulnerable communities. And also, because the mobile unit, we have a bunch of student volunteers that have always helped us every semester. And I think even though everyone's staying at home, doing remote work, they're still reaching out and asking how they can help, which is something really positive, because I'm happy to see that they see exactly everything that we've learned in public health, the social determinants of health, health disparities, and they're trying to find ways to give back and help our community right now.
I think it also highlights the importance of essential workers, skilled workers. And when I was growing up, I used to work cleaning hotels, and I worked at a childcare facility taking care of other people's children, working as a, well, I wouldn't call it essential, but was working as a waitress, and thinking about how all those opportunities have helped me to develop the skills in order to do the work that I do right now. And then seeing how nowadays there's more emphasis on the needs of essential workers and protecting them, because they do help run everything around us. You know, the people who drive our buses, you know, teachers who teach our kids, you know, people who take care of our kids, everybody who helps maintain and run society. And, you know, COVID has really brought light to how essential those folks are. And what you've seen is that a lot of folks who work in those environments are also people from underserved communities who are at high risk. And in my family, all my brothers and sisters work in those type of environments. You know, I have welders, I have people who work in factories. And so they are unable to work remotely because they have to be on site in order to work. So out of all my siblings, I'm the only one that's privileged enough to be able to work remotely from home. And that has been our conversations when we do have chats, is how do, you know, my brothers and sisters will call and say, how do I protect myself? How do I ensure that I don't bring the virus home? Because, you know, they have loved ones at home, their spouses, their children. My sister has her daughter living with her, and she is pregnant and is supposed to be due this week. And she was on a constant hunt to find sanitizing supplies and ensuring that her environment was safe enough for her unborn grandchild. So I think it really has brought attention to what essential workers are, and the conversations regarding the health and safety of essential workers, and, you know, looking at the privilege of people who are not, and how do our policies impact folks? You know, how do the mandatory masks and social distancing or physical distancing, how people get irked about it, but really it impacts the health of our essential workers, our people who are maybe highly impacted by the virus. And so these are conversations that our family has on a regular basis, you know, because they, you know, I work in public health, and so I should know these answers. And so I'm always getting questions from family members too. And I do constantly worry about family and how to keep our family members safe.
Some of my work for many years, especially in the last couple of years, has been to work with small businesses on giving them advice on how to reduce their exposures in the workplace. And this was primarily geared towards auto body, auto repair, and beauty salons, because they still use very toxic chemicals, often without not knowing what it does to them. But our project has actually been working with promotoras, our community health workers, to break down how do you think through occupational exposures. And those same principles that you would work in that same area would also work here for coronavirus. And it's actually been one of the things we've seen, I think, a lot more in the media, even here at the U of A, and the policies that are being done on campus, is this hierarchy of controls. And what can we do to work with people more about learning about that hierarchy of controls? It's a process that you use to break an exposure to a hazard down and think of all the different ways to minimize that exposure. And that's something that could be applied in many different ways, you know, through radio shows. I'm excited to hear about that, Sheila, and let me know if I can help. But also in other scenarios, to all the different work scenarios that Agnes just brought up. And so it's written into the federal code, it's written into policy, but like so many things, it's not reaching down to the individual levels to those that need it the most. And that's something we've spent a lot of time on our research team, which includes faculty from all departments actually in our college, from biostat, from health promotion. How do we, you know, in some ways combine this with a socio-ecological model of health and think about all the different levels of influence to minimize workers' exposure, because it's these workers that make it so that we can all function in our lives. And thinking about how can we get more of these messages out to more of the communities that need it would be great.
Right now, with what Paloma said, it also makes me think that even when there is policies or laws in place, I know, for example, in the community that we work with, there is still that fear to report anything. And I think working with community health workers, with the promotoras, I mean, that could possibly be a powerful way to help these employers report incidents that are unsafe or any type of other forms of violence against them. Because I think right now, if an essential worker was to have symptoms or know that somebody else in their family member came out positive, you can understand why they wouldn't report anything, because they would be scared to lose their job. Unfortunately, a lot of people in essential jobs are easily replaced, right? Especially during these times. So I think that's an area of work that hopefully will come together and also help address with the use of promotoras.
Yeah, a lot of the policy issues also, a lot of these positions don't have paid sick time off, so people can't take the time off. And then I've even, on some of the Twitter chats that I'm on, seen essential workers being told that they couldn't get the time off until they have positive test results. So while they're waiting, they're still working. And what do you do in that situation? And those are policy gaps that we need to think of how to address more broadly, because they affect everyone, right? And thinking through how do we continue to have those fears of influence as well. Those of us that can go have those conversations.
I think for Native Americans in general, with folks with the Native communities, Native nations that have casino gaming facilities, and a lot of those facilities are notorious for having smoking. And what has happened with COVID now is actually a lot of the gaming facilities were closed for a while, and they started looking at how smoking contributed to the increased risk for COVID. So a lot of our tribal casinos are now reopening as smoke-free. So that was another way of looking at how tribes are looking at environmental contaminants and how it's impacting communities and workers. So that was also one of the bright sides. I know one of our alumni from the College of Public Health has been actively working in trying to get Navajo casinos to open smoke-free, and he's been updating us regularly on how many casinos have reopened as smoke-free. So they're still working at that, and my hopes is that when our Navajo casinos open up, hopefully they'll come out smoke-free as well for the benefit of the people and for the workers.
Yeah, I really like how we're trying to find that silver lining, and the public health workforce researchers have been working with various populations, farm workers, you know, with exposures, thinking about pesticides or the smoking in the workplace. And now COVID is bringing these other obstacles to light, and hopefully they're, you know, another obstacle for these populations will be move to the front line, and we can work on some policy change in the future.
One of the other silver linings, if we want to focus on some positives, and I don't know what will happen in the long term, but the rates of child visits to the ER for asthma has almost completely gone away. And I don't know if that's because people are super scared about going to the ER, but I've heard this from pediatricians as well, because one of my other roles is in the respiratory center. So somehow by being home and not being out in cars and traffic, going to school and things like that, that we have decreased some other childhood illnesses for the time being. But it's not clear what that will mean going forward. But there's certain things we can take part in, knowing that, you know, children are spending time with their families, they're staying home, being less exposed to other illnesses than they normally have. Maybe that's helping their health in some ways.
I just worry about all the time that we're spending on Zoom and sitting down, and how that's impacting us as public health professionals who are working remotely from home, and with our kids going back to school, and hearing from parents that their kids are scheduled to be on Zoom for about 6 hours each day. you know, how is that really going to impact us? Is that really helpful to us? You know, so I'm sure there's going to be some sort of condition that's going to come out of this, like some Zoom related eye back.
Absolutely.
You know?
I think from, you know, we know all the popularity of standing desks over the last few years and how much sitting at computers is hard on all of us. And so now putting our children there, it's going to absolutely affect them, I think, for sure.
I definitely know my son's had way more screen time than we've ever hoped to give him in the last few months. So
now that they're back in school, the last thing you want them to do is get back on the screen when they get off.
So hopefully that means that we get more computer sciences in the future. Or, I mean, we know they're definitely going to be more tech savvy than we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Agnes, Sheila, and Paloma for joining us today. I think this was a really great conversation. Lots of information, important information that you all have shared with us today. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you all.